This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. The Me Too movement has made international headlines in the past year. Folks continue to come forward to share their stories of harassment, discrimination, and bullying. From Hollywood's A-list to corporate executives and politicians, the scandals are pervasive, and they forced a conversation about male supremacy. Some approach it on its face by instituting new workplace policies or trainings, and others are trying to peel back the layers to figure out how exactly we got to this point. How did patriarchy, masculinity, and male supremacy become the forces that they are today?
Well, I think it goes back to the caveman days. I mean, you know, who ruled the cave? The man.
Really?
As far as I know.
That's a clip from season 3 of the Center for Documentary Studies podcast Scene on Radio, which takes on the topic men. The creator of the show is John Biewen. He's the audio program director at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and host of the podcast, or co-host of the podcast, I should say. Welcome back, John.
Hey, good to be here, Anita.
And Celeste Headley is also with us. She co-hosts this season of the podcast and is a longtime NPR host and author of the book We Need to Talk: How to Have Conversations That Matter. Thanks so much for joining us, Celeste.
My pleasure.
So, John, last summer you were here promoting season 2, which tackled white supremacy. You decided to explore men, a small topic. Tell me about the choice to,
yeah,
to take
right.
this on.
How do you, how do you go at this in, say, a dozen episodes totaling 6 or 7 hours? Yeah, I mean, really, it came about because of the previous season, Seeing White, which was really kind of a deep look at race, not by sort of, you know, but starting with a lot of history that basically tried to say, how did we even get this thing, this notion of whiteness and blackness, right? And so the response was pretty strong and kind of surprisingly it resonated with a lot of people. But then there were some people who said, and as we say in part one of Men, every single person who said this to me was a woman. But there were quite a few women who said, what if you did something kind of similar to that on gender, right, and what's going on with men. And obviously both are kind of extraordinarily timely right now, it seems.
And so you decided to do that. You decided to bring in Celeste as a guest host. Celeste, I'm curious about how you responded to this request. I can imagine if John called me, I would be fearing being the token woman in the room or on the mic.
Yeah, but John put it to me. It's funny that you used that particular clip, because the way that John explained my role, that clip really, really kind of reflects it. Because you hear this guy saying, look, admittedly, it's a really stupid thing. And then you hear what I assume is his wife or girlfriend in the background saying, really? So that's kind of my role. If there are things that are said that are based on assumptions, longstanding societal, cultural assumptions, that I as the female can be there to say, really? Really?
And I think you all, I mean, I feel like you spend the first half of the first episode sort of acknowledging all of the potential pitfalls of this topic, thinking about gender as a binary, not thinking about race as part of this conversation. Celeste, maybe tell me about the choice to do that and how you all have tried to avoid some of the pitfalls.
Yeah, I think that you kind of have to disarm people, because when you have a topic that's talked about this much, it begins to be in people's minds to be categorized in sort of broad strokes, right? And you have already decided what you think on the matter. And what we're trying to do is sort of get beyond that. You may think you've already decided, but give us a moment and let us have you rethink that for just a second. And I love this particular approach, because at heart, the issue we're talking about in the Me Too movement, the issue that we've been talking about for hundreds of years whenever it comes to gender equality, is not really about women. I mean, we have not been the dominating gender. And so when we're talking about the Me Too movement and what has to be understood and what has to change, we're really talking about men, to a large extent. And so that's what makes this particular approach really kind of genius.
So you all do this deep dive into history and try to think about how we know what we know about men and male supremacy and masculinity. And you talk with a woman who gives a feminist critique of deep time. First of all, that's an amazing phrase. And we have a clip of her shaking up what we think about who did what in the hunter-gatherer days and the Stone Age.
In many hunting and gathering cultures in more tropical environments,
They mostly eat plants because, you know, it's hard work to go out and hunt a giraffe or something like that. The whole idea of killing a mammoth was probably something that happened once every couple of generations, and then they talked about it the whole rest of the time. So,
and did cave art about it, right?
To take one more example of rewriting anthropology's early narratives, tool making.
We know from ethnographic and ethno-archaeological and ethno-historic account, women were the primary butchers, the Arctic society women, and even the women in North America during the same time period of the so-called Pleistocene. They were making and using and refining their own butchering tools. So the whole idea that only men make stone tools, what is somebody, a woman, going to do? Sit around and wait till somebody comes back from 5 days on the hunt before making a tool?
That's a clip from the podcast Scene on Radio. Season 3 focuses on men. I'm here with host and producer John Biewen and co-host Celeste Headley. So you all go on to say that despite our common beliefs, the hunter-gatherer period may actually be more egalitarian than the past 10 to 12,000 years. Tell me about this deep history and what you learned.
Right. Excuse me. So that, yes, that was Meg Conkey. She's a scholar at California Berkeley and somebody who spent, you know, 50 years doing archaeology, kind of from a feminist perspective. So her, she and a couple of other scholars in that episode. Yeah, we were trying to test these some of these kind of general common images that we have, right? That patriarchy, it goes back to the cavemen, right? Because men were just bigger and stronger, so they kind of grabbed women by the hair and dragged them around the cave, and it's ever since then men have been in charge. Well, not so much apparently, right? So that hunter-gatherer, all the latest scholarship suggests that partly just because those communities tend to be smaller, kind of tribal bands. That everybody's kind of working on everything together and sits around the fire making decisions. And it wasn't until societies started to do agriculture, to settle down, to start to accumulate property, to start to become more kind of bigger specialized societies, 10 or 12,000 years ago, that's when men kind of made this move of kind of asserting themselves and saying, okay, we're going to be in charge. We're going to be in charge of the, you know, the governing councils. We're going to kind of own everything, including the women, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of shoving women into this subordinate position. So it's fascinating. And from an anthropologist's standpoint, that's relatively recent, like 1/20th or so of the history of the human species.
And Celeste, reproductive rights or reproductive history is a big part of what you all are tracing. Can you tell me a little bit about womb envy and what you all learned about that concept?
Right. Well, because of Freud, we all know the concept of penis envy, right? But womb envy is a relatively more recent concept, this idea that part of what motivates men is this regret and sometimes jealousy over the ability to have children, that in the end it's women who hold the future of humanity in their wombs, quite literally, and who often have an outsized impact on a child's not just birth, but their rearing and nurturing as well. And so therefore, it's this concept that perhaps some of the misogyny, some of this drive that John was talking about to control women and control their bodies is based on this jealousy over women's ability to reproduce.
And there's an incredible story about poop that I'm going to have to make one of you tell.
Okay.
John.
Excuse me. Yeah, another scholar that we interviewed for that episode, Mel Connor, told us about this is a contemporary today hunter-gatherer society in which when a woman is going into labor, the father will take an herb that makes him constipated, and he'll go out into the bush and struggle and strain to push out the heroic delivery of a poop. And then we'll come back and explain that he gave birth to a stillborn baby. And presumably then people, you know,
congratulate, yeah.
Right. So that's evidence, you know, in this view for what Celeste was just talking about, that men kind of want to be part of that drama in some way, right?
So you all go on in the second episode to tackle the question of nature versus nurture and come to the conclusion that maybe thinking about the two as opposites might be the wrong frame. Celeste, tell me a bit about how you felt at the end of that episode. I know you talk about your own experience as a mother and your complicated views on the nature-nurture question.
Yeah, and it's interesting and it's ever evolving still, and it's great that we get a chance to sort of reveal, and John especially, some of the most recent science, because as far as we know, until kids are toddlers, there's no difference in terms of sensitivity to emotion or sensitivity just as a person between a girl and a boy. And it is not until they're like 3 or 4 that they start thinking that emotions are feminine, that boys start thinking that. So this argument over nature versus nurture is personal, right? Because it reflects in how we view our own kids, how we raise our own children. And I tell a story in the episode about the fact that I thought I was going to raise my kid gender neutral, and I gave it up because certainly in our culture, I didn't find it to be possible for me. Not in modern day America, I couldn't do it.
So we learn that anthropologists get the history wrong. We know that there are differing views on how sociologists think about gender. You also look at how there's been differing views in science, even when we try to say, okay, let's take it down back to the beginning. Let's draw the human body and let's try to figure out what we can learn. So I'm going to play a clip where you talk about some ancient drawings of female anatomy. Well, John, actually, will you set up what was going on during the scientific revolution that led to these drawings?
Right. So for a long, long time, there were these very kind of old superstitions that men were just better and superior and women were kind of a pale imitation of. Anyway, so that was coming apart with the scientific revolution, where people started to be interested in what does actual evidence say? And also it's the Enlightenment, so people are starting to talk about equal rights for all. And well, how is this going to apply to gender, right? Why, if we're going to continue to exclude women from lots of things and positions of power, why? So science becomes really the answer to that question, how it's going to continue.
Let's listen to a clip.
The German man portrays the female skull as large. The French woman portrays the female skull as smaller, and she portrays the pelvis as very, very large and roomy, very large in proportion to the rest of the body. And it was the skull and the pelvis that became the sites of political debate.
To make this clear, Madame Darkenville didn't just happen to choose a model skeleton with a smallish head and a broad pelvis. Her drawing was out of proportion with any normal woman. Women's skulls are slightly larger than men's in proportion to the rest of the body. But in her drawing, Darkenville made the woman's head unnaturally small and her pelvis very big, even though women's pelvises are no broader than men's.
That's a clip from the podcast Scene on Radio. I am with co-hosts John Biewen and Celeste Headley. So Celeste, science may not be the way for us to find the answer. So you all come to the conclusion a few times that maybe we have the power to choose who we want to be in the world. Can you tell me about how you come to that conclusion?
Me? Because I think that, look, science is wonderful, and at its best, it's as close to objectivity as we can get. But another good example of this is how we came to this scientific conclusion that women are more emotional than men, for example. I talk about this all the time because I'm talking about conversations. And we did have a whole number of studies that showed women were more emotional, but it's because the researchers were men, and they were excluding anger as one of the emotions. And when you add anger back in, men are significantly more emotionally volatile than women are. So in terms of choosing your gender identity, there is no absolute answer, right? There's no nature versus nurture final correct answer on the test. There's no scientific correct answer on the test. Biologically, it's not entirely clear. And culturally and sociologically, it's not entirely clear. So it's left up to us to sort of decide who we are and what our gender means.
So you've looked at nature versus nurture. You've looked at the deep past. You've looked at the science. What can we expect in the future episodes?
Well, let's see. So actually, the one I'm working on now, which is part 4, is really we go very, very deeply and directly intersectional and sort of look at how feminism, women's movements have been entangled with, well, first of all, how racism and sexism are entangled with each other, but then how the struggles against them have sometimes competed, sometimes worked together, but are certainly deeply entangled in ways that we usually don't talk about.
So has this given you insight into how we can crack the system?
Revolution, probably. That's the short answer.
All the men could just take a vacation for a couple of decades.
Yeah, well, did you see Barack Obama said that in his his talk in Africa, where he said, yeah, we need to, men are getting on my nerves lately. Let's get
just
more women
back.
Involved.
How about you, Celeste? What has this given you insight into?
I think it's given me a little bit of insight and empathy in some ways about why this is confusing to some people. I used to have nothing but impatience for that, especially for men who are like, I don't get it. I can't say anything without getting in trouble. But now I see how complicated it can be, and I have a little more, not complete, but a little more empathy.
John? Can I say something really quick? And I need to do this because I realize that when I go on the radio, when people can't see how scene on radio is spelled. It's S-C-E-N-E, by the way. Scene on radio. Like
yes.
That. So I just wanted to get that in before we go.
Celeste, what episode are you most looking forward to that's coming up?
I'm actually looking forward to the end, when we finally sift all through this and try to come up with some takeaways.
And some what to do's, right?
Exactly. A checklist. Yeah.
Okay. Ooh, a checklist. That sounds exciting. All right. We will have to stay tuned for that. John Biewen is the audio program director at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and host of the podcast Scene on Radio, S-C-E-N-E. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Anita.
And Celeste Headley is also co-host of the podcast and a longtime NPR host. She authored the book We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter. Thank you, Celeste.
My pleasure.
You can find out more about the show and everything else we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is the technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.